Welcome to Syntax. Today we have a really great episode. We have Cameron McAfee on, who has a very decorated past. He's worked at GitHub in the very early days. He's worked at Sentry as a creative director. And he's just one of those kind of cool guys who seems to do it all. Design, development, products. It's really interesting to see someone who just like make stuff happen, whatever medium it is that they need to make it work on. So we're going to be diving into that, as well as something he's working on called GuideGuide, which is a plugin for all the different software design apps out there. Specifically, I'm curious about, like, how do you make a Figma plugin? Because it's kind of interesting that you can just build plugins for Figma with JavaScript. So pretty stoked about that. Welcome, Cameron. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's exciting to finally be on this end of the microphone.
That's awesome. So give us a rundown. I know I gave a sort of half-assed explanation of who you are, but give us your pitch of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, no problem. I've described it different ways over the years. I think product polyglot is where I ended up with just... I never got too interested in one particular part of the spectrum, and just, you know, most experts will go down one part of the path, and I went in every possible direction, which, you know, makes it hard to be hired for one thing, and you have to sell yourself harder. But it's good because you can talk to all the different people and understand the different bits of everything. But yeah, like you said, I worked at GitHub, I worked at Sentry, those were in creative capacities. But always had my hands in code, and I've always liked moonlighting as a software developer. So these days I consider myself an independent software developer. I think that's the lifestyle I like. The creative thing's important to me, and I care about it, I use it, but I think I'd rather be mad at code than mad at like creative politics and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. What came first, the code or the creative design aspect?
The design thing. I went to school thinking I was going to become an illustrator, and then thought I was going to be a motion graphics artist because I started learning Flash, and I thought that was really cool. But then I realized motion graphics is extremely tedious, and I couldn't stand it. And I started learning ActionScript at the same time, and realized I could write code that would then animate the stuff for me. And that kind of ruined my life, because at that point I realized I could just build tools.
Yeah, very similar to my trajectory. I was going into motion graphics too. Got into Flash, even interviewed at a couple Flash jobs, and moved into code, and was like, yeah, I'm happy here. We can make things happen with code in all kinds of ways. So you have a long history as being like a creative director. Do you want to maybe give the audience some perspective on like what that entails exactly?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are two paths on the tech tree you can go down. There's the creative director that's kind of the Don Draper type, where you are the creative visionary and everything comes through you, and the people on your team are kind of like your minions that you use to work your creative work. And I'm not that style. The other direction is more it is my job to create a creative space where the people on the team can be highly functional. And so my job has been more focused on how do I become the roadblock to all the roadblocks, so that the things that normally slow creative people down are not there, and that they don't have to think about those things. Right. So like removing the office politics, removing the project management dysfunction, that kind of stuff, so that all they have to do is come in and be creative and then show off their work. And the way I've looked at it as, you know, if a project fails, that's my fault. And if a project succeeds, that's their fault. I think it's really important that a creative director is there to like amplify the people on their team and then kind of disappear.
Yeah, that makes sense. Especially as like, that seems like the ideal strategy for any kind of director, right? You hear the word director, inherently people think, hey man, this might be the person that is creatively in control of everything. But in reality, you're more or less, you're directing. Here you have like a overarching vision, but you also know how to unlock the talented people to do the talented work, which is, I think, a hard skill to get out of the way and you know, work that hard.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of people flop as they're promoting, is that realizing that when you take a promotion into some sort of management or organization mode, you have to turn off that creative part. And like, there's places where you can use that.
Yeah.
But like that, your creative ability is no longer the thing that you are being judged by. And so, you know, it's always good to bring that experience and have in your back pocket the answer, but then see if the room can solve the problem first.
Does taste come into factor more at that point?
Like, oh, for sure.
Acting is kind of like a judge or a, yeah, arbiter.
Yeah, I would say that's an important part where your footprint should still be seen. And I think, you know, in like the GitHub work and the Sentry work, you can see where my influence was there without, you know, explicitly being imposed. And yeah, a lot of that comes from taste of saying like, you know, yes, we will or won't make this decision, but you can figure out how you want to do it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always curious about this because it's not something that I dip into a lot. Like I design stuff for the website and for whatnot, but it's pretty much just like, just make stuff that looks cool and let her rip. But in larger organizations, you have like people, everybody's got an opinion on something and things get watered down and people have all this feedback. And is there anything that you do to sort of like shelter designers from that type of thing where it can be really like you still want them to just kind of go wild and to have and be really creative, but then there's this other part where it's like there has to be some sort of feedback loop. You don't want to beat them down too much.
Yeah, it is definitely a hard thing, and I would say that was the crux of my trial by fire in my career. Was we had a point where we had a marketing leader that was just causing all kinds of trouble for us in terms of like unrealistic expectations and all this stuff was happening. And I knew personally that it was not our fault that these things were not like the expectations were unreasonable. And so it was not our fault that we were not delivering on them. But when I sat down and tried to articulate this, I realized that we just had no structure. We had no project management. We had no documentation. We had no rules in place. We had nothing. And so, you know, ultimately it was our fault because we were not able to do this. And so I think the realization I had was that all of the problems we had came down to ambiguity of, you know, we couldn't answer questions. We couldn't provide answers to we couldn't answer the questions, but we also didn't have answers ourselves that we already had. Mm-hmm. We didn't have documentation for the processes. We didn't know how long things would take. And so I think, honestly, just like sitting down and documenting everything was the solution to 99% of the problems. Because the thing that I learned is, especially being an early employee, is and if you're an early employee with the word director in your title, even if you're not a director, which was my case, like by rank, not a director, by title, had director in there. Mm-hmm. And if you've been there for 2 weeks longer than the people that you're working with, if you have a piece of paper that says this is how we do things, people generally don't question it. And so that was my takeaway, is like, come in with the documentation. And then, you know, when someone comes in and says like, well, can we make this green? Cause green feels good. And like, you know, we can say like, nope, on this chart, it says we don't use green. And they say, oh, okay. and then you move on. And once you do enough projects and you just write down how long it took over time and like what the kind of project was, you start to see patterns in there, and you can just, you know, make the sheet of this is how long this type of project takes. And so, you know, when someone comes to you and says, how long is this going to take, you know, to build a new web page or whatever, you know, you can say like, yeah, do you want a good one or do you want a fast one? And if they say a good one, you say, well, all right, you're looking at 8 weeks. And they go, oh my God, 8 weeks. And it's like, well, here, let's talk about this. You know, you need a week to do the illustration. Honestly, you need one day to do the illustration, and you need 6 days for you guys to, you know, whinge about how you don't like how it works. And then we need a week to do the copy. And actually, no, we need a day to do the copy, and then 6 days for you guys to talk about how you don't like the copy. And then, you know, and you go through this process, and you know, they feel off put by the time at the beginning. But then when you nail it at, you know, 8 weeks, and you're not running over the, you know, over the things, and your artists aren't mad, and the marketing people are happy that they got what they want, it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, believe it or not, knowing ahead of time is not that hard when you've done it, you know, 100 times.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's a lot of egos at play, too. You mentioned like having the paper you can point to and maybe getting some of the emotional side of it out of it. But like, in terms of dealing with egos in that space, or just in general, you know, hurt feelings, mm-hmm. do you have anything there that you've experienced on how to mitigate somebody feeling hurt if their baby is not well received.
Yeah, I think going into a project, and you know, you eventually build a rapport with the people that you work with, but like going into a project where you don't have that, it's really good to explicitly state like, this is where the boundaries are of like, this is my responsibility, this is your responsibility. You don't have to enjoy this, but I am paid to do this and you are paid to do that. And you know, there's still, you know, some headbutting that happens in there, but when you have that conversation out loud with people, because there's a lot of stuff. Taste is this very, it's very touchy feely, and you know, everybody has taste. Everybody thinks that their taste is good, and everybody thinks that they're good at their taste. And so you know they perceive that the Venn diagram overlaps, or you know, it blends, when really those are very separate circles. And so it, you know, it is a rare skill that you meet someone that understands their place in the pipeline. And I mean this as a like a defensive creative person, but I also mean this as just a person that works in the like in any team of, you know, if the marketing people come to me and say like, this is not converting well, you know, it's not my place to complain that it's not converting well. It's their job to worry about that. And so like, that's not my place to give them a hard time about that. So, you know, it kind of goes in every direction of like, you know, it's just a lot of managing expectations and being very clear and articulate about, you know, we are here to have taste, and this is kind of where the boundary of that happens. And you are here to have your, like, you have your goals, and we're not going to tell you how to do that part. And so that mitigates a lot of it if you have those conversations up front. But then, you know, when you get into it, there's still some of that you have to get in there. And, you know, you can worry about people's feelings, and I think there's a lot of space for that and where that's really important. But then I found a lot of value in being the scariest person in the room, where people are, you know, if you're in, I think people in the creative fields are usually on the defensive a lot. And so one of the things that was important to me was that the people that I work with see my team as really great people to work with and me as a big brick wall, because, you know, like somebody has to be in there and say like, we cannot do this. And I'm comfortable being the bad guy if it means that the rest of my team can operate comfortably. And, you know, like the first time you meet a person, that they prickle at that. But then once you talk to them and they realize you're not an asshole and you're doing it to protect your team, then you start to work together pretty well.
Oh, that's awesome. And you're responsible for a bunch of kind of neat things at GitHub, specifically the 404 500 pages, the design.
Yeah, that was my like hiring test. A friend of mine told me, so back before I worked for GitHub, I was just trying to get a design job, and he suggested that I put some code on GitHub because that would make me viable, and I had no idea what that meant. I didn't understand version control or Git at that point. And so I pushed some code to GitHub, I think. I don't know if it ever actually made it. But then he, you know, a few months later told me that they were looking for an illustrator. And so I applied to the job kind of blindly, thinking, you know, I can draw, let's try this. And so they asked me, or they, you know, they told me they got this mascot that's a cat octopus thing, and they wanted to put it in a, you know, a different outfit. And so they asked me to figure out, or to design images for the 404 and 500 pages. And that was basically the extent of the thing. And so me being naive to copyright at that point, was just like, sure, let's dress it up as Obi-Wan Kenobi. And, you know, this isn't the page you're looking for. You know, thought it was hilarious and sent it to them, and they loved it. And the CEO at the time came back and was like, hey, can you make this parallax? And, you know, I think the sensible thing for an artist to say was no, or sure, I can figure out how to download a library that'll do it. And instead, I wrote some really awful jQuery code to make a parallaxing library, and then open source that. And I think that kind of won them over on that. You know, it's still available. It's called Plax. And I think there's a big banner at the top that says, please don't use this. Someone else has made better code than this. You know, you can trust it as much as you trust anyone's code from more than a decade ago, but you know, it was a lot of fun, and you know, they're still there. I think the parallaxing might be gone, or I know that it was rewritten at one point, but yeah, it's just an
image now. You're not responsible for the unicorn when it goes down, are you?
No, that was there, and thankfully we don't see that as much anymore. But it was the octocats and then the unicorn, you know, every few days.
Oh, that's good. The octocats is Really interesting. Oh, man, I was just on the 404 page, and all the parts are still individual images, but it's not parallax any longer, which is interesting. So they must have ripped that out, but just kept the individual images. That's amazing that the 404 page is still the same thing, because that was, what, 10 years ago that you did that?
Yeah, at least? I'm like honestly surprised that they haven't taken it down. You know, considering how probably every other part of the code base has changed, except for maybe one under construction GIF that lived in the code base forever as a joke. You know, I'm surprised those pages are still there.
Oh, that's great. I was curious about the Octocats as well, because there's like every time I'm at a conference, I get a whole bunch of Octocat stickers. And they're all different. I'm like, man, like, is there one person designing these, or is it like The Simpsons where just same people, they have the same style that they're able to reproduce?
When it started, it was just me for a while. Like if you go to octodex.github.com, it's a list of all the ones that they've made. I don't know how often they update it now, but it definitely gets updated. But there's little avatars on there that tell you who did them. And I did a bunch of them to start out. I think I'm still the one that has done the most of them. But then a few of the other GitHub designers did some of them. There was a GitHub engineer that did a couple, which was really cool. And then once the creative team at GitHub like officially became a thing, we started formalizing how that worked, and we would hire illustrators, and we documented style guides of how all that stuff worked. And then at some point, you can see a very clear change in the style where we brought in the actual illustrators that understand anatomy and all this stuff. They came in and things got really good and unscalable for me to manage, and which was good because that was in my transition into the leadership role. And it's like, great. Yeah, I can finally achieve the dreams that I've had in my brain by letting other people do it for me.
Man, some of these ones that you did are cute. It's super cute.
I definitely feel like I hold the title for most beloved ones, like the Dia de los Muertos one and the Grim Reaper. Excuse me, the Grim Repo. those ones are definitely some of the like the hottest ones we ever had. Just like people love those ones.
I definitely have stickers of ones that you have designed, so that's pretty sad.
Yeah, they're plastered all over my MacBook. Did you ever got in trouble with using like The Simpsons or Minions or anything like that for these types of things?
I'm afraid to say it out loud because then somebody's going to find it. But yeah, no, like I don't believe that we ever got any, you know, like cease and desist things on that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it fell under parody and they just didn't want to bother, or, you know, nobody had heard of this small company named GitHub. But yeah, we didn't run into issues with it, but we definitely hit a point pretty early on where we decided, okay, we cannot keep doing this that. And, you know, tempting people to attack us. So yeah, you'll also notice the point where the use of IP got cut off and we started going down like cultural routes and whatnot.
Yeah.
Cause at some point it started out as, like, you know, how many fun versions of this can we make? But then at some point we started realizing people were identifying with it. And so then the mission became, okay, how do we make it so that people can be the Octocat? And like that was, you know, talking about taste and, you know, how you influence that. One of the things that I really wanted to avoid was trademarking the Octocat, because if we did that, then we had to be super litigious about it. But if we copyright it, then we can still protect it, but we can make it so that if someone wants to use it and we're cool with that, that's totally fine. And so, you know, then it became communicating to people like, you can't use this to make it the logo for your business. Like, you are not the Octocat, but you can use it as your avatar on GitHub. Like, that's great. I'm glad you identify with this. You know, make it how you want. You can make your own, add pink hair, or, you know, do whatever you want to it.
Yeah, I went down that route. I think it was a couple of months ago. I had an idea for a parody sticker, and I was like, I wonder what the licensing on Octocat is, and then I realized, yeah, you're not allowed to do it. And I have been served cease and desist in the past from freaking Patagonia.
That Patagonia,
I don't mess with that anymore.
Yeah, they trademark mountains.
No, it was the actual Patagonia logo.
I took the Patagonia sticker and I just like replaced Patagonia with JavaScript. And same logo, same everything, right? And then I had 10,000 of them put into packages made, and I got them. I took a picture of it. I put it on Instagram. I'm not lying. 45 minutes later, I got a cease and desist in my email box. And I was like, it was the devs. The devs at Patagonia followed me on Instagram, and they like hotshotted it to legal right away. So I had a cut. I 10,000 packs of stickers open and take it out of them. And now somewhere in a landfill, there is 10,000 Patagonia JavaScript somewhere stickers.
In Scott's house, there's at least like 40 of them. Because yeah, you sent me a whole bunch of them. I got one on my monitor over here. I can see it every day. But I like had posted a photo of it one time, and Wes is like, "You gotta take that down, man. You can't keep that up."
Now that I know a little bit more about cease and desists and like how they're the first line of like spooking people out of any legal trouble, I probably could have got away with it. But at the time, I was just like, I'm not getting sued by Patagonia.
Yeah. And IP is such a sticky scenario because, you know, like, being a creative person, I care about it on both ends of the spectrum. And, it's people come in and use your logo to make it themselves, or they want to use your content. It's like, well, no, like, you need to be creative with your things. This is me. You can't use me to sell you. But then there's also this whole world of stuff of like, I want you to be able to use it and enjoy it. And, you know, I don't care if you mess with it. Everybody doesn't understand it until they do. And then, you get a lawyer in your inbox and, it's, you know, suddenly you're afraid of how to use things.
Yeah. Let's talk about Sentry. What kind of stuff did you do when you were at Sentry?
So when I got hired, I was the second designer. Chris was the product designer, and I was basically everything else creative. And so I came on and was working on all of the marketing content and doing illustration for that. And my title was always creative director, but it was kind of silly to say I was directing when it was just me. So the goal was always to eventually grow the team and turn it into, you know, a full-fledged thing. But in the beginning of that, I did illustration for all of our stuff and kind of created this isometric style, which was by no means groundbreaking, but was different than what our competitors were doing at the time. And took some of my code background and did some, I think it was some like SVG and CSS related animation on the homepage to do like a, it was like a power outage scene, and the lights would like slowly flicker out in the city behind, being like, you know, you've up a deploy and now everything's falling apart. Sorry, cursed again. But my favorite part was like the power outage rolls across the city, and then the call to action button like flickers on, like it's, you know, backup generator has come on. And so I was doing that kind of stuff, and we would do blog posts and would make illustrations for that sort of thing. And then hit a point where just I couldn't keep up with it. And so hired an illustrator to actually come on board. And when I brought her on, we sat down and we talked about the illustration style. But at that point, our competitors were starting to do kind of like similar looking illustrations. So we decided, you know, how do we capture what's good about what we are and like what's good about what she did and create a new style out of that. And so from that, she came up with this new style that had a lot of the like blocky geometry, but a lot more fully anatomical characters and had a lot more range to it. And then I took her illustrations and I designed a new brand on top of that that felt more in line with it, because ours at that point was very gray and neutral. And so we introduced pinks and oranges and became this like kind of weird unicorn spectrum. When I pitched it, I described it as Taco Bell, but good. Because it was very like
that's so great.
It was like very, very 90s Taco Bell style. And I even had a reference image of the Taco Bell that was near my house, because, you know, we had these, like jaggedy lines and these colors that worked, you know, kind of from that palette. And so, bringing her on, she changed the illustration style into that. And my capacity became more designer and, designer developer and kind of providing guidance brand wise. And then we hired another illustrator and copywriter, and just like started growing the team from there. And this was about the time where I had that, you know, kind of come to Jesus moment about like what it takes to run a good creative team. And so, I sat down and I made a chart of all the roles that should exist on a team. And then I wrote down who was responsible for it. And it was something like, you know, 12 or 15 different roles. And I was 13 of them. And you know, that doesn't seem scalable. And that was, you know, reason number one for why we were so slow. And so I created like here's the chart now, and here's what the chart should look like, and the roles I need to hire to do that. And just slowly started checking my way down that list of, you know, bringing people on that could do those things. And as I would release a responsibility that, you know, and or as they take that on, I would release that responsibility. And at some point my job became more, the political and organizational and the taste side, and then still software development. Cause I love to write the code. So, you know, they would design it and illustrate it and all that. And then I would build it.
Oh yeah.
Cool.
No, sorry. I got one more question about the illustration. Cause I always find this mm-hmm. super interesting. We have a bunch of illustrators that do my stickers and some of the syntax shirts as well. And I watch them and they're all iPads. They just sketch it right out on the iPad. What's your process for illustrating something like that from idea to getting it into like an SVG?
I probably scare illustrators, or, you know, it's that one of those things where it's like, you can't watch another person do a thing. Yeah. So I come from the last generation of creative tools where the pen tool was everything. And so
yeah.
You know, I start and I sketch and I get it kind of close to where I think it's going to be, you know, enough that my brain understands the anatomy of what's going on. And then, you know, back when I was illustrating more, I would scan it. But now, you know, I can take a picture with my phone, which is fantastic. But then I'll plop that into Illustrator, and with the pen tool and the mouse, I just start clicking away. You know, I'm a fiend for Bezier curves. And so it's just, you know, I go in there and like I work all in vector. You know, I think like a lot of the Century artists are, you know, bitmap based, and they paint stuff and then we'll convert to vector later potentially. But I always prefer to work in vector, because, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with these things eventually. But yeah, that's mostly my process, pen tool. And
that's cool.
You know, it makes other artists uncomfortable, but I'm pretty fast with it. So it's, you know, it works for me.
How'd you get good at the pen tool? Just straight reps?
Yeah, you just gotta go out and lift every day, and, you know, eventually you get swole with the pen tool.
It's
the keyboard shortcuts, really. You know, like, you gotta get your mm-hmm. alt key and all these things, and you figure out, like, you know, which one changes how the paths work. But yeah that and the Pathfinder. The Pathfinder is the one that lets you, like, merge shapes, and so, you know, those two are my go-to tools.
All right, let's talk about Guide. So this is a plugin you've had for how long? Tell us what it is and how long you've been working on it.
Yeah, I think I launched it back in 2010. Prior to getting the job at GitHub, I was an intern, it was a job at a design firm or a motion graphics firm. And they had hired me thinking I knew how to do motion graphics because they had seen my videos, which they didn't realize at the time were all based on, you know, code generating. So they hired this motion graphics artist that couldn't do motion graphics and realized, oh, we got to build a web department around this guy. And every year my bosses would take this long vacation, and, you know, we wouldn't have any client work to work on. And I had been doing all these Photoshop mockups of websites. And every time a client would say, you know, oh, can we take a link out of the navigation? It would crush my soul, because I had to update 17 files and remeasure all of the little buttons and get them all stretched out. And I got sick of doing this, like, this one tedious task over and over and over. And so I started looking at scripting, because I knew that was a thing, and wrote myself a little script that would let me put in a number of segments and a distance, and it would just, like, plop guides in there equally spaced. And that was kind of my, like, caveman make fire moment, where I was just like, oh my God, I just pressed a button and I saved an hour and a half of work. On one of these vacations that my bosses took, I dove into how the Photoshop plugin system worked. And, you know, back then you'd build like a flash plugin basically that would then work with like MXML, and it would interact with Photoshop. And I added a interface where I could put those numbers in instead of having to do it in code. And like, that was so cool. And I think right about that time, I published that on my website. And, you know, at that point, I was nobody. But then I got the job at GitHub. And at that point, GitHub would always post when somebody got hired. And I think that week after I got hired, Guide exploded. I in hindsight, I should have looked it up then. I never did. So, I have no idea where it blew up. But I was starting to hit like millions of downloads and was, you know, seeing people installing it in, you know, big name companies that I'm sure don't want me to say that they were customers. But it was everywhere, and it was a free plugin at that point. And, you know, it was great. you know, in hindsight, looking at all the tweets, because, like, you know, I had to turn off notifications at some point because people just kept talking about it. It was, you know, it was very, very exciting, but very disruptive. In hindsight, everybody was excited about, like, how it was free. And so, you know, like, naively at that point, it was like, you know, people are loving that I'm solving this problem for them, which, you know, definitely at that point of Photoshop based web design was the case, but they were really in love with the free thing. And then years later, I decided, you know, I would like to earn money for this effort I put into this thing. And I started charging money for it. And, I think I shared a graph on Mastodon of my site visits. It, you know, it went from like 50,000 page views a month and then just like tanked immediately when I started charging money. And, you know, my wonderful popularity died right there. But, also my amount of money that I was earning started going up. So, you know, I can't complain about the trade-off, but, I apologize. I think I skipped describing what the plugin does. So the whole point of it, you know, it started out as like, how do I measure space between stuff? But the whole point of it is grids are a really important part of design. And you know, I like to describe it as lining up stuff with other stuff. You'll see a young designer come in and they just plop stuff on a page and it's all misaligned and things are kind of out of whack. And, you know, a grid is the invisible structure that exists in a page so that your brain doesn't have to solve where stuff is and it kind of understands like what's going on. And so GuideGuide is a plugin that lets you put in things like, you know, margins and columns and rows and specify, you put these things in and then you run it and it puts guides in your document that, you know, they don't print in the files that you export. They're just there while you're designing and help you line stuff up. It was so much more relevant 10 years ago when we didn't have Figma and Sketch and, you know, better design tools. Yeah. Now it's still relevant, but the tools have gotten so much better these days. Photoshop added a feature that was basically identical to what I had built. So, you know, I'll take credit for their inspiration there. It started out as a script where I would add values in JavaScript and then became a plugin where I could work in the interface. And then it hit a point where it became my personal testing ground for stuff. And so, halfway through its lifetime ago, I added a text parser to it so that I could create this language that I call grid notation that would let you write out kind of like equations that create grids, because I wanted to start doing stuff. I mean, honestly, I just wanted to try it, but I wanted to do more powerful things. Like, you know, every tool you'll see will let you put in rows and columns and gutters. Like, these are kind of, you know, rote topics. But then if you want to add like margins to your columns, or if you're doing like, if you're the kind of designer that loves incorporating math into what you do, like, you know, using the Fibonacci sequence or the golden ratio, the tools don't support that kind of stuff. And you know, like they're very on the rails. And so I wanted to go off the rails. So I created this language that lets you put in equations for how you outline things and let it just do the math for you and figure out, you know, where things go and how to evenly space stuff. That's what it's evolved into, is this kind of power tool for how do I put guides in this document so I can line stuff up in the ways that I want that are beyond what these built-in tools can do for me.
Yeah. That's really cool. So you essentially made your own language called grid notation. Did you have to write like a whole parser for that?
The first time I did it, I have rebuilt GuideGuide, I think, 8 times now. I think that's the last time, I think. But the first time I did grid notation, I wrote my own parser, and it would just, I think the method was called chomp, and it would just like chomp like a Pac-Man its way through a string and interpret stuff. I think I would like split on spaces and then try to interpret like what was in each token to figure out what it was supposed to do. When I rewrote it for the current version, I switched to a JavaScript based parser called Moo, I think. And it's I'll look it up so you can put it in the show notes. There's a type of parsing style. It's like ENRB or something, and it's basically this, it creates this parse tree of like you tokenize your string where you like chunk it up into little bits of meaning basically, but it's a whole bunch of substrings, and then this parser has a tree where you set up things that are kind of like regular expressions, but it's more like pairings of types of tokens that have meaning. And it just like rips through your document and associates these and then comes back with an abstract syntax tree where it's like, here's everything that's in this text in the form of JSON data. And then from there you can say like then you can start using logic on this, but it's, yeah, it, like it starts as regexes, and you know you can write a regex of like, this is an integer, or this is a pipe character, or this is a tilde, and then you tell the parser like, you know, an integer can be followed by the string px for pixels, and so if you ever see like integer px, that means that's a unit input, or if you see a pipe character, that's a guide thing, and then what you get on the other end is just a JSON blob that's, you know, like, here's an array of all the tokens we found, and then from there you can start doing science on top of that.
Just loop over them. Yeah, that's how Babel works, and that's how pretty much every JavaScript parser, TypeScript works, is that somebody has wrote an AST parser for that language, and that's how ESLint works, actually. And then you can just start looping through them and saying, all right, well, if this thing is preceded by this thing, or if this thing has occurred before, then throw an error. That's really interesting. I had never seen this. It's called No Contacts Moo, a highly optimized tokenizer lexer generator used to tokenize your strings before parsing them.
Yeah, and I can provide more of the links for that, because it's a multi-step chain. There's like the lexer for it, which is what tokenizes it, and then there's the actual parser for it, which I think I'm forgetting the name of that one. But yeah, it's a fun rabbit hole to go down of interpreting text.
Yeah. One question we had previously, I've asked many times, and I think we've gotten to the bottom of it, was like, can good colors be calculated? And we think the answer to that is no. But I'm curious, A, your answer to that, and B, can good design be mathed? Can you calculate good design?
Can it be gridded?
Oh god, that's a good question, and I don't think will be solved in my lifetime. It's funny, my dad asked me about this recently. He wanted to build a business card where he's got like this logo that's got multiple chunks of colors in it, and he wanted it so you could like click on the colors and it would change the colors and basically like, generate palettes for you. And he was asking me how practical this project would be. What I ended up telling him was just that you can math colors for sure. And you can do stuff where you like are comparing contrast levels and these type of things, but taste is such a hard thing. Of like, you can put these two colors together, but should you? And that's I don't know that there's a way to solve that. I mean, maybe we just haven't figured out enough math to do it. You know, maybe we can LLM our way through it and just, you know, statistically come up with good color combos. But I don't know that you'll ever come up with a color library that has good taste. I think that's just like the permutations are too complex there. And then as far as like, can you math design? I don't know. Like everybody is, you know, scared about AI right now taking our jobs. And, we will definitely cut out like a whole base layer of, I don't even know if you can call it creativity, but of like templatizing, like that kind of level of things. Did Squarespace take our jobs? Like, you know, they built a bunch of really great templates that take, you know, design out of the factor for most people. And so, like, you know, some designers lost their jobs from that, maybe. I don't know. But, like, the AI stuff is only ever going to get as good as the information we give it. And so, you know, I think as long as we are still being creative, we've got an edge on that. And so, like, you know, I don't know if we'll get tools that can design better than people so much as design as good as the last thing that they saw.
Yeah, it's you look at Midjourney and you ask it to design you a website and it kicks out things that were really popular on Dribbble 3 years ago, and it's the whole trends have changed since then. But obviously whatever it's been trained on has not been updated on that just yet. So I always think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think the beauty of creativity is that it's completely unhinged, and like you can't control it, and you don't know when it's going to happen. And you know, like I don't know if you're this way, but I'll wake up and there's that like liminal space between being awake or between being asleep and my kids coming into the room where my brain kicks into gear, and like the reasonable part of me is still asleep, and so it's just like chaos and things and interesting things happening. And I wake up, and I've had multiple times where I've woken up at like 3 a.m. and thought like, this is great, I'm half awake, I need to write this down. And then I look at it in the morning and I'm just like, what in God's name was I thinking? And yeah. but it's like,
I hit that
that's
every
where,
night. Yeah.
That's where creativity comes from. It's like, it's turning off good sense and just letting your brain run with it. And, you know, I don't think we can build a tool that does that for us, because the tool is always following some sort of rule. Like, you know, like if you think about the resolution of a screen, like, it looks beautiful and the edges are nice and smooth, but if you get really close, it's still squares. And so with creative tools, you know, you can zoom far enough back to feel like, ooh, this is creative and great, but it's still working with the rules that it's been given.
I love your liminal space comment, because I have on my to-do app, essentially it's just a to-do board, and it's called Ideas to be Filtered. And it's specifically for any time that I am in that space and I have my biggest, best idea ever, I throw it in Ideas to be Filtered. And the concept is that I will then take it from the Ideas to be Filtered and I will put it into my actual to-dos to create the thing. The thing is that, like you mentioned, so many of those ideas just don't go anywhere, aren't good. So my Ideas to be Filtered is just massive bunch of like dead ideas, just an idea graveyard. I have a question about building a plugin. You know, as a engineer, you can challenge and take tasks on programmatically. Was it intimidating at all? And like, what was the process of even building a plugin like? And how did you just get started with that?
I hesitate. I don't know how to answer that, because you're like condensing a 13-year journey into one decision. I think that decision then versus now is very different. Going into it now, well, if I rewind 5 years before the previous the current iteration of GuideGuide, I was just building them one off, and every time I would make a plugin, I would have to rebuild the entire thing, and it would take a year to build, or whatever it is. And then I finally realized, and actually I took Wes's course on React and learned about how to build these nice, more sensible applications. I built it as a React app, and it's basically like a inside out API where I've got the plugin, which is a React app, and it's just I don't know that headless is the right word here, but it can make method calls to do stuff, but they don't do anything. And then you plop that inside a wrapper that then has a connection between the application and the plugin. And so the plugin says, I want to add a guide. And then it just like calls out and hopes that somebody listens. And then the plugin hears, I need to add a guide, and then does it in the form of that application. And so now building a plugin takes me like 3 weeks, because it's, there's like a week to hook all that up, and a week to do the like rebuilds the UI so it looks like the app, and then a week to do the marketing stuff. Wow. So like in that regard, it's not that intimidating anymore, because it's just I just need to read the docs and figure out how to connect these things. Going back more than a decade, I don't think I knew what I was doing. It was just I know I can do scripting and I can do a bit of math, and I want to not do math anymore. And so it was just, can I write code that does this? And it's the, you get that urge late at night of like, I've got this idea and I should go to sleep, but instead I'm going to read these docs and try this. And, it's 4 a.m. And it's,
just me last night. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so exactly. I don't know that it was intimidating back then, but it was because I was naive about what I was getting into. And, now I've learned so much that it's not intimidating, because I know what I'm into. So, it's somewhere in there, it's been scary, but it's just, software developers are driven by fixing things. And so, I couldn't turn it off if I wanted to.
Yeah. So Sketch, Figma, InDesign, Illustrator, and Photoshop, they all have JavaScript APIs for interacting with it and adding guides on top of your artboard?
Yeah, they do. Each of those apps has JavaScript APIs of some sort. Some of them have like lower level languages. With Photoshop, you can use C++, which would be the better one to use, but it's not my wheelhouse. But with all of these plugin systems, you usually have two environments. You've got like the web view environment, which is where you have your interface. and mm-hmm. you can build whatever you want in that sandbox, and but it doesn't know anything about the application. And then they all provide some sort of way of bubbling messages up to the next level environment, where it's kind of more like a Node.js type world, where there's some sort of API to interface still with JavaScript with the host application.
That's cool. I had no idea that you could just build, like, I always thought, oh yeah, you could script it with JavaScript, but mm-hmm. you can also embed like a web view UI. I often think about these like audio editing tools. You buy an audio plugin to like add auto tune or whatever, and every single one of them have these hilarious like knob turning interfaces. And I often wonder, like, oh, what are these things built in? And I'm curious, hey, now, Wes, if any of them are. Yeah.
My best friend in the whole world owns GoodHertz.
Oh yeah.
Yes, and he builds audio plugins for a living. And even though he does more of the DSP side of things, they use web tech. They use SVG. They're using HTML. They're using JavaScript inside of these things for the interface. I'll post some of his, because they do have wacky interfaces as well, and some of which are gorgeous and really interesting. But yeah, I know they use web tech. We should get him on the show. We can talk all about
it. Yeah, that's cool. And in order to make it feel native, do you just have to like re-implement the UIs of Photoshop and whatever, or do you just kind of go with a generic Mac OS look?
It depends on the platform you're working on. So Photoshop in their current iteration, they've gone through, I think, three since I've been doing this. They yeah. have like their current version is not actually a browser. It's like an interpreter that mostly simulates a browser, but it supports web components. And so they've built out a suite of web components you can use that will mimic their styles that they're using in the app. Cool. Yeah. That's a case where you don't have to do as much work styling. With Figma, there's, I think, is mostly unstyled. So yeah, by default, you would get it like just bare HTML, but you can then go in and you know recreate your own version of their interface. I think Sketch injects a bit of native style, so like the inputs you get have an orange highlight around them instead of the native blue, but you still have to implement a bit of it. So each of my plugins has like there's the core where that logic doesn't change anywhere, but then there's the API, which is what communicates between the app and the plugin, and then there's like the style layer that is on top of the core, and I inject components that have been styled to fit the current the app, so it looks like it blends in.
Yeah, that's cool. That's kind of similar to React Native, and if you've ever built a Raycast extension, because Raycast uses React, but Raycast is 100% native, and they just use React to make their own components. And to interface with their low-level APIs. And you can't use HTML and CSS inside of it, but you can use JavaScript to sort of architect it. And then the compile step brings it to whatever like a drop-down is in Raycast. I thought it was always neat that they make these things accessible via JavaScript, even if they're not actually rendered in web tech.
Yeah, and it's I love this as a format of the, you know, like the app can be written in whatever it is, but they expose JavaScript as the API because it's so accessible, you know, for better or worse. But it's the barrier to entry is pretty low, and you know it gets more complicated once you want to be a competent software developer and add things like you know TypeScript and whatnot. You just have to start building out the pipelines that work within these systems, and they're all so quirky in their weird ways. Like the Photoshop system, well, all the Adobe systems have, when you're using JavaScript to interact with the application, you're using something they call ExtendScript, which is a version of ES3 that they implemented, which is great because like order of operations works differently in that, and so your transpiler will take out parens that you put in to enforce order of operations, but that then breaks the logic because the interpreter interprets it differently. So you have to do crazy things like that. And their stack traces, their stack traces don't include column numbers. So if you want to use Century, which I do, I'm not plugging. I just like the product.
Of course you do.
Like, yeah. you can't add. you can't add minified code because it'll just tell you it was on line one, which was, you know, super great. So I had to like hack up the minifier so that it would break everything into lines at least. So, you know, like I get a vague approximation, but I at least know the line of code that it was on. Because I can only get, you know, line numbers on the exceptions. So they've all got these weird quirks. Sketch uses CocoaScript, which compiles JavaScript into Objective-C. And when I first started with the Sketch one, you could actually write Objective-C, which is this like nightmare of brackets instead of any sort of sensible syntax. And now it supports Swift, which is JavaScript-ish looking. So it, like, that feels a little bit more comfortable when you do it, but it's that all of them have this weird compilation confusion and chaos in there. Figma, you can't do multiple files. You get an HTML file, which runs your plugin, and a JavaScript file, which runs your API. And so if you want to add a React app in your plugin, you have to inline the entire React app into the HTML file because it evals the entire file. And it's, you know, you run into all these weird edge case things that you have to figure out how to account for in your bundler, and basically to make this stuff work.
Man. Wow. And how are you architecting all this? Do you have a big Webpack config or anything like that?
Yeah. This is one of those things where I wish I had listened to Syntax before starting this project, because I committed hard to CommonJS right before I did this.
And, oh, folks, this is why you got to listen.
Yeah, if there's one thing to take away, it's listen to Syntax, because I've been
and buy Sentry. Listen to Syntax and buy Sentry. That's
But I have been picking out bits of CommonJS for a long time, and I'm using Webpack, which I wish I could move on to Vite, but Vite doesn't spit out multiple assets. From what I've seen, like it's very much designed to like just spit out one thing, whereas like I need different types of outputs for different things, because you'll have to like output your plugin JS, but you'll also have to output your interface JS and do these things separately.
I have a Vite setup that kicks out a different CSS file for every single course, and I'm doing some stuff to make it work. And like, yeah, it's not easy. I agree.
Yeah. But it's like, I can see obsolescence happening as I'm sitting there. Cause it's, you know, like I'm using Jest, and I've hit some sort of issue with my tests where if I test, I can test one plugin, but if I test all the plugins, I hit some sort of memory leak where it eventually just fails and I don't get any test results. And I'm just watching an issue where it's like a problem in Jest that they just kind of won't fix. And the Sketch version, it uses libraries that were created by Sketch for interacting with them, but they're written using Webpack 4. And so everything is Webpack 5 except for the Sketch version, which is Webpack 4, because I can't compile using that. So it's a nightmare of gotchas everywhere, and I know it's going to ruin my life at some point in the future.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Well, we're approaching the time here. It's at 55 minutes, so I think we want to wrap it up. Is there anything that you wanted to hit that we didn't get to?
No, I mean, I got to talk about my interests, which is always fun to do. So, yeah, I think I'm good.
Nice. Cool. Well, let's get into the part of the show where we talk about sick picks and shameless plugs. Is there anything you would like to sick pick?
Yeah, I've got a list of three, and I can go through them fast. But so the first one is the Ember mug, which I've for the longest time resisted buying an expensive mug that keeps my tea hot. But then the first time I realized I had hot tea after 90 minutes, I was sold. So I would say, like, if you can get over your ego, get one of them. They're great. Then I wanted to sick pick the band Water Parks. That's like a pop punk band that's been around for about as long as Guy Guide. And I've been enjoying their music, but I went down a rabbit hole researching them, and they really won me over when a guy posted on Twitter that he got a tattoo of one of their song titles, and the tattoo artist accidentally wrote the same word twice in the tattoo and fucked it up. And so they went into Spotify. They went into Spotify and Apple and all these services and updated the name of their song to match his tattoo. So,
oh, nice.
Like, I figured, like, okay, these guys are my band from now on.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then one for code, Execute Program is a really cool website for learning different things, not to take attention from y'all. But that's been cool. I haven't even used it in the last year, and I just left it active because I was enjoying donating to them just because of how much they give you a challenge and you type it in and you learn the stuff as you do it, and they do a lot of like cycling repeats of it, and it's just a really cool system to learn. And now that I'm learning Swift, I wish that there was something like that for that.
Totally. Yeah, love it.
God, those are some sick picks.
Oh yeah, Wes, who was it? GitHub sent me an Ember mug one time. Ooh. For being a GitHub star. So I do have one. And you are absolutely right, Cameron. It is. You pick it up after a half an hour. Oops, I forgot my tea. Still warm.
Yeah. Whenever I end up having a drink in a regular mug, I'll come back to it and pick it up and nearly do a comedic spit take when it's like, oh my God, this is tepid.
That's great.
Do you have any shameless plugs for us? Is there anything you'd like us...
I mean, obviously Guide. I just launched the Figma version. I'm trying to spread the word as far as I can. So that's guideguide.me, and you can do /syntax. It'll give you 50% off the first year of using it.
Oh wow!
Mostly throwing it in there so I can track to see if converting is working. It's been great. I've been experimenting with different types of promotion, and finally made my first sale. It cost me $3,000 of promotion to get one license, but maybe deciding not to do that, but hey, yeah, it's worth tracking.
Pricing on this is really good, by the way. I should just say this is not a... I loaded the page and I saw $9, and then I was like, a month, and it's a year. That's an awesome price.
I've gone through different iterations. It used to be a lot more expensive, and with this one I decided to scale it back to try to fit more how I want people to use it. And it's actually, I call it sort of pay what you want. Like all the tiers are exactly the same. They're just priced for different intended uses. So you can just buy the cheapest one and get all the benefits. But you know, I've got the different plans there in case you want to do it the way I kind of wish you would do it. And then my other shameless plug is just my website, CameronMcAfee.com. There's not much to look at, but you'll be able to find where I operate there.
Tech. Well, thanks so much, man. This has been incredible. Really loved hearing everything here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun. Yeah,
thank you. Peace.